Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Screen Strong Families podcast, bringing you the best solutions for parents who are serious about eliminating screen conflicts in their home. This is Melanie Hempe, and welcome back. If you're new, we are so glad you found us. So we have a wonderful guest today, but before I bring him in here, I just have to tell you something that happened yesterday. You know, I get emails and I hear from parents all the time about screens and kids and how they are really sabotaging their relationships and their life and all this. And so I heard from a mom yesterday who said to me, "Melanie, if you don't allow video games and social media, your kids will live in a bubble." And oh my goodness, I just grin when I hear that because that was what I used to believe. I mean, there's so many myths out there. And there's so many biases. And I had these huge blind spots when I was raising my older kids. And I think one of the biggest ones is we really believe that if our kids are not exposed to everything in the digital world, that they're going to be weird or they're going to be not able to live in the real world when they leave our house. But what I want to explain and what I am explaining to this mom, unfortunately, she's really listening. She just really believes this myth about the bubble. But what I want to say is that we all live in a screen world, right? We all live in the digital world, but we have two choices. We have a choice that our kids can be exposed to everything and they can have all the video games and all the social media and all the stuff and phones and all this stuff. Or we can take a different pathway for our kids and we can use tech more as a tool and then say no to these things that are going to be so distracting and they're going to be hurting our kids. So this is a fabulous option to delay. We're not saying get rid of it forever. We're just saying to delay. I'm not saying that you even have to take this choice, but this is a screen strong lifestyle and this is what we promote and it works really, really well. And then I will also argue that kids who spend 8 hours a day on their screens, they're the ones that are living in a bubble. It's not the other way around. Screen strong kids do not live in a bubble. If anything, they are more interesting. They're better at real life skills and they're going to be just fine when they leave our nest. So I just want you to think about that myth a little bit today. And Tom Kirstein is joining us today. And I'm so excited to introduce him because we're such good friends and he and I are so aligned in the way we think about this issue. So welcome, Tom. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Melanie, how are you? Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to it.
So, Tom, I just have to tell everybody, okay, you, for the longest time, 25 years, you were a school counselor during the day and in private practice at night, right? Kind of like Superman, right?
Yep.
So, and I have to tell everybody that Tom is a nationally renowned speaker and author and a TV personality. So I'm not kidding when I'm saying that he's Superman. He's hosted shows for the National Geographic Channel, the Food Network, Oprah's Wellness Network, and every now and then you can flip on the news and there he is. There's Tom. My kids are like, "Mom, there's Tom again." I'm like, "I know. I don't know how you get these gigs, but you get called to do some education here for our country." So we're so excited to have you on the show. Tell me just a little bit about your private practice right now.
So I retired early, young. Just over a year ago, I did my 25 years in public education. And I was burning the candle at both ends. I was working at the high school as a counselor and coming into my private practice every day after. So now I'm exclusively doing my private practice. And I'm working full time again because that's how busy it is with all the, particularly from the COVID lockdowns, what we're seeing with kids nowadays. So, you know, this past year has definitely been a bumpy road for a lot of people. And there's maybe some stuff we could discuss that I'm seeing related to that and how screens tie into that.
Oh, definitely. I think kids are just getting more and more isolated and more into their digital bubble. So your book is called Disconnected, and this is our book of the month. And boy, do I love this. In fact, you know, I picked it up again this week as I went through to get the notes and everything for the show today. And I have these little packets of sticky tab kind of things that you can put in your book when there's something really cool that you want to mark. And so what I realized is just after the first two chapters, I use my whole packet of tabs.
It's
So now the whole entire, I think every page has a tab. So I'm thinking that's probably not helping me narrow things down. So today what we're going to do is we're going to go through part one and part of part two. And then our next session with you, our part two of this podcast, will be on the solutions. But I'm so excited. Let's dive in. Y'all, listen, the reason why we love Tom so much is because he has been in the school, in the classroom, really in the counseling office there in the school with these kids for 25 years. So when you drop your kids off in the morning at school and then you wonder what the heck goes on for the next 7 or 8 hours, Tom knows. And so when you read his book, it's so fun because you're reading like a bird's eye glimpse, you know, you're getting a view of what's happening in your kid's brain. I just love when you do this in your book, Tom. I love the way that you talk, like in this one, you're talking about Sarah, and we're going to talk about Sarah in a minute. But let's start with why are you so passionate about this issue and why did you write this book?
Yeah, so it started, you know, I'm actually one of the first pioneers, I think, in this whole space because it was in 2008, believe it or not, talking over 12 years ago, where at the time I ran a committee at the high school called the 504 Committee. And I talk about this in the book. And basically that committee, if we have kids that the parents that come in to meet with us, if they think their kid has some kind of a disability, then they may be eligible for accommodations under regular education law. So it was in September of 08. And we had a meeting with a parent. And I remember this is a high school, so these are teenagers. And the parent had come in and said, son was just diagnosed with attention deficit disorder, so we're looking for accommodations. And I remember just thinking, that was the first time I ever saw that, believe it or not, being diagnosed at that age.
How old was the boy?
14 years old.
14, okay.
You know, so the first thing going through my mind is, wow, I can't believe, you know, it's a really good school system. I'm like, you know, I can't believe this kid fell through the cracks all these years. Because the average age of diagnosis for attention deficit is 8 years old. And if somebody has a kid with ADHD, you can't not notice it by the time they're 5 years old. So long story short, for the rest of that year, it was like every referral we got was for kids diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. And that's why I started researching what was going on. And everything I came across that I lay out in a book pointed to the fact that kids at that point were spending so much time in front of screens. This is before smartphones. And it was changing their brain chemistry and mimicking symptoms of attention deficit disorder.
Wow. And in your book, it's called acquired ADHD?
Yeah, that was a term. Some of the research I did, a professor out of UCLA by the name of Gary Small, right around that time, had conducted research, did a whole study called Your Brain on Google. And again, remember, this is 2008. And I think his stuff was like 2007, 2006. And it was just basically, we were kind of new to all this. And you know, he was just trying to figure out if all of this time that people were spending in front of computer screens and stuff, was it doing anything to their brain? And it was. And one of his researchers, you know, coined this term that he referred to as acquired ADHD. And that's what really set the light bulb off in my head. I'm like, holy cow, is it possible that all of these kids that I'm seeing here diagnosed at 14 and 15 years old probably don't even have attention deficit disorder? They have a brain where the neural pathways with brains grown new neural pathways, and they've now adapted to this cyber world and can't function in the real world anymore. So that's when I really got rolling with this. And I remember doing my first lecture. It was in March of 2009. And I was talking about this research, and it was really a forewarning back then to parents, because I was hypothesizing at that time that if we didn't start to get a grip on this, then we were going to start seeing some more serious issues occurring, like depression and anxiety and all this stuff. And people thought I was crazy at first. And it turns out I was right, because all the research came out after that and supported everything I talked about.
So this acquired ADHD, this is so fascinating to me because I don't think the parental world out there understands this, that ADHD is usually noticeable by 5, usually diagnosed by 8. I mean, that's just kind of the common pathway for that. And so the fact that they had to create a term for this is fascinating. And these are kids that have inattention, lack of focus, disorganization, impulsivity, hyperactivity. These are all the symptoms, right?
Yeah, exactly right. All of that. And, you know, essentially it's this, you know, like you mentioned earlier, the average kid, depending on the research you look at, is spending somewhere between 8 or 9 hours per day, right?
Yeah.
On screens. And something called brain neuroplasticity. And what that is, the human brain, we have these neurotransmitters, our neural pathways in our brain that are the electrical impulses that are critical to human functionality. And the way the brain works, if any human being is involved in anything that's considered highly stimulating for 3 hours or more per day, the brain will literally grow new neural pathways to adapt to that environment. And we know that kids are spending nearly triple that amount of time in the most highly stimulating world. So certainly what's occurring then, it's kind of like this. Now you have a kid whose brain is constantly, constantly stimulated all day long. And now they have to go sit in a classroom and listen to Mrs. Smith, you know, for 7 hours. And they're all over the place. Their brain does not know how to concentrate and focus. And then they start falling behind in school. They go to a pediatrician. Yep, you check off all the boxes for attention deficit disorder, even though the kid doesn't even have ADHD, because ADHD is not something, it's not really acquired. That's just a loose term. ADHD is a neurological condition that you're born with. You don't pick it up as you go along. You're born with it. But a lot of people don't know this. And I lay that out in the first, really in the first chapter, kind of like a wow factor.
Yeah, no, it's very, very educational. And the way that you write is so well done because it's just so easy to understand. And I just appreciate that so much. So thank you so much. It's very easy for parents to understand. And it's as if you've been working with parents for like 25 years. Oh, you have. That's why you're so good at this. So the activity patterns in the brain start to change after all of this. It's almost like their brains are kind of being reformatted to this digital environment. But the problem that you point out here is they're getting, they're having a lot of problems. The excessive screen time is linked to trouble maintaining eye contact, difficulty interacting with others, anxiety, depression, behavioral issues. I love this one. I mean, I don't love it. I hate it, but struggle forming friendships and struggling to fit in and no coping skills. That is such a big deal that starts to, you know, show up around 12, 13 years old when they hit middle school. If your child is really struggling to form friendships, that's a red flag because that shouldn't be hard. That's a natural thing for kids to do. So talk about that just for a minute about it's not just the anxiety and the depression, but these other issues, these social issues.
It's kind of multifaceted in many ways. So we know that kids in that age group that you just mentioned and older spend more time connecting with their friends through a device than they do face-to-face. Mm-hmm. Now, face-to-face communication is learned behavior. To be an excellent communicator, you're not really born with that. It's learned, and it's learned by doing it on a regular basis, the way we've done for millions of years. And if you're not using that skill regularly in a face-to-face way, you miss out on a lot of the nonverbal communication, the nuances, the facial expressions, and all those other little things. So that could certainly affect communication, which can affect forming friends. And another part of it as well is that kids that are really heavily, you know, immersed in their screen time. And what I'm seeing now, and I'm sure you're seeing as well, Mel, is, and I work with teenagers every day at my office, is close to 100% of them. I had to throw a number on it, probably 99.something%, are spending nearly all of their time in their bedrooms.
Right? Oh my gosh. Yeah.
And I'm not even just talking about for home, this is before COVID.
Yeah. Right? Now it's worse.
Home, and they spend all of their time in their bedrooms and barely come out. You know, they barely sneak out of their nest and come downstairs. So that's going to affect real life friendships and communication skills and everything else. And now you throw COVID into this mix. And, you know, we have kids that are homeschooled on their screens and they're just fatigued and kids that have this acquired ADHD, it's almost impossible for them to learn, you know, through Zoom. And then when they're done with their schoolwork, you know, they can't go anywhere. And where are they? They're back in their bedrooms. They're on their phones all day. They're on TikTok. They're on YouTube. They're on Netflix. So they're really, and that's a whole nother thing we could talk about. So it's really, that's adding a whole nother layer of problems now.
Oh, definitely. Well, I love on page 23, you go through a day in the life, I guess, of a typical 16-year-old girl. And you have, her name is Sarah, and she's waking up and her mom is having to come wake her up because she's exhausted because you're explaining all through the night that she's been, you know, checking her phone. She gets up before she even rolls out of bed. She's checking her messages. She's in the bathroom probably with her phone checking her messages. She's so distracted. You know, she she gets in the car, she's still on her phone. She's already sent all these selfies and all this stuff and done all these. I mean, this is exhausting. I read this again. I mean, I've read your book a couple times and I'm just exhausted reading this. These kids that are trying to maintain and build a brand every day. And then you make the point that, you know, kids are trying to figure out who they are, where they fit in, why they look weird, what friend group they're a part of, right? So this already insecure daughter that you have is now taking a step off a cliff. I mean, you know, now she's on social media and it's sabotaging everything else that she needs to be doing in her developmental state.
Yeah, yeah. Like, and if you look at it like this, right? So when I was out there, I was out there lecturing before COVID all over the place, but now I do some Zoom ones occasionally. Which is fine, but it's not the same as it was actually being out there, really connecting with people. It returns, we'll see. And I know you do the same as well. But a perfect example is, I mean, not a perfect example, what I always tell people, and I don't even know if I mentioned this in the book, is that when you're looking at a pre-adolescent or adolescent, all right, so if we can give a one-word definition to adolescence, the word that I would choose is insecurity, right? Now, forget it. Look, even go back 30 years ago, all right? So insecurity, so it's a developmental stage of life where you're transitioning from childhood into adulthood. So it is this like sort of middle purgatory area where it's all about trying to, who am I? What do people think of me? Kids are changing hormonally. They're going through puberty and everything is about where do I fit in? What do people think about me? So there's an automatic insecurity and it's supposed to be that way. That's part of the developmental stage. But now in our modern day world, you know, we hand these kids these modern day weapons of mass destruction called the smartphones. You know what I mean? That have, and now you have this kid that can now compare him or herself to every single peer, right? You know, every detail of every day going on in every one of your peers' lives, right? And now the kids are starting the process of now I'm comparing myself. Everybody else's life is so much better than mine. And now they want in on this action and they start posting videos and content. To get something in return, to get attention. But what I talk about that I point out in the book that to me is very important is the word self-esteem. And I call it cyber self-esteem because self-esteem starts with the word self. And it's how I feel about myself. And it's not anything that can ever be brought in from the outside to the inside. It must come from, that's where our kids are getting tangled up right now because their whole sense of self is predicated on what others think of them. Or what they think others think of them, not what they think of themselves.
And that doesn't work at all.
It does not work. Otherwise, it would be called others' esteem instead of self-esteem.
What a good point. That's an awesome point. We're going to have to quote you on that.
Hey, so how's your others' esteem been lately?
Let's go build some others' esteem. No. So it's fascinating that you talk about in your book about how you used to get calls every week, you know, from the nurses, from kids having anxiety, panic disorders. Talk about that because you said that you started getting more in 1 week than you would normally get in a whole year. So what is this? I'll say this Sarah, okay, she gets up, she's not, you know, has not had a good night's sleep. She's looking for her identity by looking at other people all morning. And then she gets to school. And then what happens in class that the nurse would call you and give you this referral?
It was pretty fascinating, actually, Mel. So, you know, when I was talking about this, all this attention deficit stuff with kids being referred to my 504 committee back then, and it was like literally almost all of them were for kids. The disability was attention deficit disorder, right? And around, so that was like 2008, right through into about 2012. And around 2012, there was now a replacement came in, all right? So the number one issue we were dealing with now, number one disability was kids with major anxiety issues. And that's why, when you look at the fact that smartphones really started coming on the scene right around 2012, and that's when, you know, kids were now walking around with these things in their hands, in their pockets, 24 hours a day, just getting, you know, immersed in all of this information and all of this content, you know, just being driven into their subconscious minds. All this anxiety started happening. It was so bad and still is that I give some examples in the book where starting at around that time, you know, I would, you know, occasionally get a phone call from one of the nurses saying, you know, I got a kid that's in the office. They're really having an emotional meltdown. There's some kind of a panic attack or something. Can you come bring him into your office? And I would come and I'd collect the kid and bring him into my office and we'd work him through it. So after 2012, I literally started receiving more of those phone calls per week than I used to get per school year.
Wow.
Yeah. And in my private practice as well, I started getting kids around that time, middle school age kids with major anxiety and panic disorders, more of those, you know, in a 1 year period than I had gotten in my entire career collectively.
And what does that present like if in the classroom, like if you're the teacher, how do you know? I mean, just I hate to sound like, you know, I don't know, but I don't think any of my kids have ever had any kind of anxiety issues. Thank goodness. But do they just say they have to leave the room? How does it present?
Yeah. So a lot of times it would be a kid that, like, as soon as they came in the morning, they couldn't even get themselves to go to the classroom.
Got
and then
it.
There'd be some kids where it'd be just at some point during the day. And often, sometimes the kids would just, they'd be in class and it would start just shaking. And before they lost it, just would get, not even say anything to the teacher and just get up and leave.
You know, right.
Deal with that part afterwards. You know, because they didn't want them to be put on the spot. And then we'd have some kids where they had accommodations where they felt the onset of a panic. They would be able to just, you know, the teacher was kind of aware of it and they can cue the teacher and then they could, like, kind of raise their hand and say, can I go to, you know, okay, go to the bathroom. And then they, you know, bail out of there, come down, go to the nurse and wind up in my office. And you know, when you really think about it, so people would say, how does anxiety, like what is all this screen time after doing anxiety, right? Well, let me put it in perspective. Kids aren't sleeping. Prior to my retirement at the high school, I asked about 200 students over the course of a year, privately in my office, what time they go to bed at night. And these are kids that knew me and trusted me. And the majority of them, nearly all of them, told me that during the school week, they went to bed between 1 and 4 a.m. every night. And their parents did not know it. So that alone, that sleep deprivation, is because they couldn't get off their phones. So the sleep deprivation component in and of itself is enough to create that overwhelming feeling of anxiety during the school day because you're just not functioning, right? So
sure.
There's that layer. And then the other component causing kids to fall behind in school because they can't get off of their phones and stay on top of their schoolwork and they're multitasking while they're doing the homework and their grades are slipping and they're getting yelled at by their parents and they're not sleeping and they're comparing themselves to everybody else. It's like the perfect storm to create anxiety and depression.
It is a perfect storm. And you're just reminding me of a conversation I had with another school counselor who said that Mondays were really bad because everything that happened over the weekend, you know, the girls would come in to her office on Monday and they couldn't go to class because they were, you know, so anxious about all the things that happened over the weekend that they weren't invited to or included in or tagged on or something.
Yep.
So I don't know if you saw that, but they, for some reason, she would say it was just really hard. And my question, Tom, I mean, like, where are the parents? I mean, I'm a parent too, but like on the weekends to have a child come into the class at, you know, on Monday morning and can't start school because of all these horrible things that happened on the weekend. I mean, aren't weekends supposed to be family time? I don't know. I guess when you're a teenager, it's different.
Well, you know what it is too, Mel? And, you know, I know you and I have definitely spoken about this in the past is, another issue here is that parents are spending just as much time, if not more than kids, on their own device stuff. And I talk about this in the book too. I say that if we had hidden cameras in households across America, the typical family of four would not be definitive of the word family. It would be more like four individuals that just happen to live under the same roof, staring at their own screens, doing their own thing. And that's kind of what our society has become. So even with those, like you just mentioned that example with that school counselor, that's definitely part of it. But something else that is occurring right now that got me thinking about what you just said about the weekends and then Mondays being difficult. What I'm seeing now as well is kids that never had a problem before ever. When they have a school lockdown for 2 weeks, I've dealt with this right here in my office where kids are going into panic mode in terms of going back to school. And the reason for that is because that bedroom I mentioned has become like their cocoon. It becomes their comfort zone and how our brains work and form habits. From being in that bedroom for an entire 2 weeks secluded, that becomes a comfort zone.
So you don't want to leave.
Yeah, now when you must leave and go back to normalcy, it's like entering the lion's den. It's just the sympathetic nervous system triggering the stress response. So what I'm going to predict, and I will bet my house on it, and I wish I didn't have to, is that when schools return back to normal, they better hire many, many additional counselors, because they're going to have their hands full with kids that have school phobia and school avoidance issues.
School phobia. Wow.
Yep.
I totally get it. I mean, even what is it, 21 days that you do something, you start to develop a habit and your brain starts to create these new pathways. And I know even with the kids, if for some reason their sport, right, doesn't meet and they're not playing baseball or they're not playing basketball, you get out of the habit of that and it's really hard to go back. And that's kind of what you're talking about. In your book, you talk a lot about the bedroom situation. And I just love that you keep bringing that up, because I think we'd get rid of half the problems if we would not allow all this stuff to happen, you know, at night, in the bedrooms, in private. Yeah, I think in your tips, and this is really cool in your book, you've got tips at the end of every chapter. So that's really good. On chapter two, there's tips here about no screens in the bedroom. I love this tip. If your child already has a phone, which I know that you agree with us that they don't need smartphones, but if they already have one, do not send them to school with their phone. What part of this is so hard to understand for parents? Your kids don't need their phones at school.
Yeah, the issue there is that the phone has become the umbilical cord for the parent. That's the real problem. So because parents become so dependent on knowing where their kid is at all times, they track them, they have GPS trackers on their kids' phones. They're getting pumped news into their minds about kidnappers and this and that. So it's more frightening for the parent to send the kid to school without the phone than it is, you know, for the kid to not have their phone at school. So that's a message I try to convey to parents.
And we recommend a great talk text phone. We have the information for that in the description on this podcast if you're interested in that. So it's still, you can still get in touch with your kid if you need to, but they cannot get to the internet. They cannot get to social media.
Yes, Gab Wireless.
Yes, that's it. It's the Gab phone. I've spoken
with them myself, yeah.
Yeah, we both my boys have that. And it's just a no-brainer, because it's super hard to get addicted to the Gab phone and to even care about it other than calling, you know, you're texting when baseball practice has been moved back or whatever. So, but sending a smartphone to school, what a bad idea. I mean, not only that, Tom, the cheating that goes on, and I've talked to lots of teachers about this, about, you know, how can they not be distracted? Let's talk about distraction for a minute, because in your chapter two, you're talking here about physical problems and all the distractibility. Talk about a teenage brain and distraction.
Well, you know what it is? It's, you know, I'm actually working on the next book right now. It's going to be coming out in August of 2022.
Oh, good.
I can't tell you too much about it just yet. Oh. Essentially, what's ultimately happening now, Mel, human beings right now, kids and adults alike, we're ultimately being distracted from the most important thing of all, and that is self. Okay. And what is self? Well, for me, it's spiritual. It goes much deeper. But if we're never, you know, in the silence or in the now, then we don't really know self, right? So we're just living in this external fog all day long, right? And it's kids and adults' immediate almost reflex to distract oneself by picking up their devices when they have nothing to do. And what they're ultimately distracting themselves from is the deeper sense of self, where self-esteem is, where our morals, our values, our spirituality, and all that other stuff is. It's the rest of the iceberg within us. Everything else on the outside is just the tip of the iceberg. You know, think about that for a minute. And when you look at, like, I actually right now, I have Facebook, right? I have some social media. I don't post any, you know, I just use it for, you know, promotional purposes. But Facebook has become my psychology laboratory over the last couple of years, where I go in there and I study human behavior. And I see people, you know, who proclaim to be, you know, these wonderful, you know, tolerant people that are the most intolerant and evil, and some of their anger and hate that they're spewing out. And the reason for that is this, right? When you think of the deeper part of self, even at a spiritual level, what does that represent? That represents all that is good, right? All that is good. And if we're never there, then, you know, what is evil? Darkness is the absence of light. Evil is the absence of good. So if you're never connected to self, you're missing out on the good. And now you're exposing yourself to evil in the form of how you're, you know, portraying things and stuff you're saying about other people. And we see it right now with the anger and hostility going on in our country.
Yeah. Well, and you talk about that in chapter three. I'm thumbing through this, the development of self-esteem. And then you've got bullying and fear of missing out. And, you know, these warning signs that you talk about in here on page 70, I do this all the time. I read things all the time. I'm constantly interviewing people. And I love your warning signs here. They're a little bit different than some of the other ones that I've read. I'm just going to pick on a few of them. Loses track of time when using electronic devices. Becomes agitated when interrupted. Boy, is that insightful there. Prefers to spend time with electronics rather than being with people in person. Does not follow time limits. A lot of these things that you're talking about is about this idea of managing time. Here's another one. Forms relationships with people online. Loss of interest in other activities. Seems restless when not using a device. Preoccupied with getting back on. Avoids homework and chores because of spending too much time with electronics. You know, you really know what you're talking about, I'll just say. I mean, not that you had any doubt that you did, but this is what it's like living in a house with a kid who's really obsessed. And back to what you were just talking about, this being detached from their inner self and who they are and their identity, that's a huge warning sign too. And so the distraction is, from what I'm gathering as I read this, is they get distracted because the phone is so, and the game, of course, is so distractible, right? It's so persuasive in the lure. And they could go, honestly, Tom, I would imagine they could go for weeks without ever having like a private thought about who they are.
Yeah. And it's a shame because they're being stolen from by the tech. And what they're being, their souls are being stolen from them. When I give lectures, Mel, I mean, when I started doing lectures, it was exclusively to parents years ago. And then, you know, schools would say, all right, we want to speak to the kids and so forth. And what I always did when I had a big group of kids in front of me, there'd be a couple kids right in the front. And I'd say, I'd just kind of pick on one kid. And I'd say, all right, I have a question for you. Who are you? And a kid would look at me and say, well, what do you mean? And I'd say, well, who are you? And I know what the answer was going to be. The kid would say his name. Well, I'm John Smith. And I'd go to the next kid. Who are you? Well, I'm Peggy Jones. Okay, great.
Yeah.
And then I would say, well, guess what? That's what your name, but who are you? And they can't answer the question. Well, what do you mean? I don't understand. Well, tell me who you are. And the point I'm trying to make is that all of them should answer that question as follows. You ready? The answer should be an automatic, well, I am a powerful, motivated, loving, caring, empathetic, deep, spiritual human being. But then again, how could we know, how would a kid even know what that means if they don't know who they are?
Right.
Yeah, and that's the thing that really bothers me the most about all this is that, you know, yeah, we got all the anxieties, the depression, but it's a constant stealing by big tech with all the little things they dangle in front of kids because it's so addictive, and it's like their soul is being stripped from them and it's being, you know, brought into this cyber world and out of the real world and away from the real
world. Yeah, and you're right. They don't know who they are, and that's why they're so anxious and they don't have any time to figure out who they are. And just when you said that, it reminded me of this. We have kids over at our house all the time because when you're screen strong and you don't have a lot of video games or any video games and your kids don't live in the cyber world, you tend to do a whole lot of things in real life. So I have a Petri dish over here all the time of teenagers, by the way. If you ever need anything, just let me know and I will take a survey very quickly in my kitchen because they're usually sitting there eating something. So just give me a call. But right when you said that, what came to my mind, I just remember, we had a group of kids over and somehow they were talking about their favorite things, like their favorite sports team and their favorite car. And somebody asked another kid what their favorite color was. And they just kind of had a blank stare. And they're like, I don't know. I don't know what my favorite color is. And that just triggered that thought in my head that how do they know what their favorite thing is if they don't even know who they are and they haven't even thought about it, right? They're just looking at what everybody else is saying their favorite things are and who they are. So in the tips here in chapter three, you have this is awesome. During homework, no music and no phones. How brilliant is this? it's so hard to understand. Okay, Tom, tell me. I thought my kid tells me that they need to listen to music when they're doing homework. This helps them study. Is this not true?
Well, it's just that, you know what it is. They can't not have some sort of a device as part of the extension of self. So the music is like, all right, that helps me really study. So I don't know, but all I know is this, that when I was, before my gym closed down for good, you know, I would run on the treadmill, and I've been a runner and an exerciser for like 25 years, and I've never once listened to music or watched TV while on a treadmill or an elliptical machine. And I would like, either read my Kindle, or I'd close my eyes three quarters of the way and I go into a deep meditation. And all I know is this, if I was reading my Kindle and, you know, and Van Halen came on in the background, okay, in the gym on the speakers, there's no way I was digesting any page I was just reading. You know what I'm saying? So, but the other part of it too is almost every kid, any parent listening right now, when your child, middle school or high school, is doing their homework in their bedroom, let's say, and let's just pretend COVID's not even here, or actually let's pretend COVID is here, that phone next to them is distracting them every 5 seconds with an alert. And it's dividing their attention among different platforms. And the human brain is incapable of doing that.
Yeah.
Well, multitasking. It cannot do that. So there's no way, like, for example, even on Zoom school, if the teacher is, you know, lecturing, you know, through the computer screen or even in the classroom, but let's just use, you know, online school. And even for a split second, the kid gets that quick alert on their phone. They just missed what the teacher just said.
Yeah. And not only do they just miss it, but it takes a while to get their brain back in sync with the teacher. You don't just pop in and out of these multitasking kind of things. There's a huge cost to it. One study said it takes 20 minutes to get back on task when you're interrupted, when you're in the flow, if you're working on something and you know, okay, you're writing your book and you have a thought and you're unpacking it, and then you get a notification and you get off track. It takes 20 minutes to get back where you were. I mean, that's just unbelievable to me.
That's fast. I didn't even know that. But that makes a lot of sense. Yeah, absolutely. I know you've written and so forth. It's like, you know, there's times when I'll sit down and I have an idea of, and I don't even know where to start, but then, you know, you just start writing something, right? That's related to what you're thinking of writing about. And then after, you know, maybe once you get going, you get in this zone.
Right.
Like you just go forever, you know, and stuff is just flowing. But you're right. If you get interrupted, boom, you got to start from square one again.
You got to go back and figure out where you were. And you really, most of the time, never can really get right back where you were, you know.
Yeah, totally.
Right. If you write a paragraph and you're in the zone and you're writing an essay, and for some reason you delete that paragraph is gone. You can try to write it again, but it's never going to be the same. And that's kind of how it is with our kids. And when they're on all these Zoom calls, and oh my gosh, that's a whole nother discussion for another day, but they're so distracted. Just like I tell parents, if I'm doing a presentation and you have your laptop out and open and you're supposed to be watching my slides, right? Tom, you do this all the time. If people are in the audience and they actually have laptops open, you know that they're checking their email, they're checking their social media, they're checking what's on sale at Amazon or whatever it is. It's impossible not to do that. So this multitasking thing, but the fascinating thing about multitasking, as you know, is kids, every teenager thinks that they can do it. They have this very inflated opinion of their ability to multitask.
Yeah, that's right. And some of the research, I actually have a chapter on that in the book, and I give some examples that people are going to have to read the book if they want to find out. What's interesting is that one of the guys that did a lot of, this guy Clifford Nass, who did a lot of experiments on multitasking out of Stanford, discovered that the higher the level of multitasker, the more lousy they actually are at multitasking.
Well, that makes sense.
I got to share a funny story with you while we're on it. So I remember a couple of years ago, I was doing a parent lecture at night somewhere. I don't remember where it was. And it was, one where, you know, you could bring your kid if you want, right? I always encourage that because it's not really, you know, inappropriate that I talk about. And so there weren't too many people. There were some kids there, but there was a mom that must have dragged her, if I had to guess, 10-year-old, 10 or 11-year-old, and they were right in the front row, right in front of me. And it was like driving me crazy. I was like getting distracted. So the mom brings this 10, 11-year-old to the lecture, you know, because she wants this kid to hear me. And the kid, from before I even opened my mouth to the time I stopped, was on her phone the entire time.
Well, let's give her a quiz.
Did not hear a word I said.
No, she couldn't hear anything. It's just impossible. And this is what's so frustrating for parents, because most of the time when your kids are in school now with COVID, they do have their phone right next to them. And it's really funny. I have quite a few friends that are teachers, and they say that when you're looking at, you know, first of all kids should have their videos on, by the way. If you're a parent out there, be sure your kid has their video on. But she said that you can see when they're texting each other, because one kid will have his head down, and then a few seconds later, the other kid will have their head down, and you know that they're like reading texts back and forth.
Yeah. Well, imagine being the teacher, Mel. Right? Imagine you got, you know, you're on Zoom and you get like 20, you know, little square heads of people. Like, how is the teacher supposed to, you know, unearth what's in their brain in a lecture form if they have to now monitor and watch at the same time to see if all these kids are doing, or like, you know.
It's just so sad. We've got to get these kids back in the classroom. We've got to get the smartphones out of the classroom. There's nothing good about the smartphones in the classroom. I mean, anything that you need a smartphone for, you can use your laptop for. You don't need the little private screen. I want to just ask you a question about privacy. We got to start to wrap up here in a second, but what is your thought on kids and privacy in screens? You obviously, you know, can only imagine what my thought is on that. I don't think anything should be private to the parent if it's out there in the public domain. But what is your thought on that?
Well, the debate there is this trust issue. You know, trusting your kids. So I bring myself back to my childhood, my parents, my dad, you know, a very, very Catholic, and, you know, go to, you know, my mother goes to church every day. So my dad, that's how we were raised, very Catholic, said grace before dinner, all that stuff. And, went to church every Sunday. My father would say to us, if we said, oh, come on, can I do this? Why don't you trust me? Da, 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 da. He would say to us, God didn't give you to me for me to trust you. He gave you to me for you to trust me.
Yes. Right? I love it. That's what I say all the time. I didn't even know you were going to say that.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. And that's what it comes down to. So, you know, and one thing I, you know, that I remember when I was down in Charlotte, you know, we met down by.
And you did a big event for us, by the way. I don't know if I said that at the beginning of the show. Tom did a wonderful event for us. So, yeah.
Two things that I took away from you. You know, yeah, it's two things that really resonated with me, because we learn off of each other. You know, I'm trying to pick up what I can from other people, and you're doing the same. And a couple things, you know, that dawned on me that you had brought up was we hear all the time, and I use this, you know, that we want to teach our kids how to be, you know, how to be, you know, good digital citizens and so forth, right? And to be in control. And the truth is, they can't. Period. They're not capable. We have to, brain doesn't allow them to do that. We have to do that for them. And then the other thing that you had said to me that really, you know, stuck out, because the question would always be, you know, what's the appropriate age? And, you know, what you had said is late adolescence. And I couldn't agree more with that. There's a big difference. Like my son, for example, he's going to be 18 years old. So all of my two, they're delayed, you know, the last to get anything. And there's, you know, no social media. So my son is going to be 18 years old in May, and he's mature now. So he can handle stuff. You know, it's not like he's 12, 13 years old anymore. So he just got Snapchat for the first time, which is fine. You know, he's going to be 18 years old. He can handle it. You know what I mean? And he does handle it. It's just, you know, he can communicate with his friends and so forth. But had he gotten Snapchat or Instagram when he was like sixth or seventh or eighth grade, I'd have a completely different child on my hands.
Or even 16. Let me tell you, there's a big difference between 10th grade and a senior.
Without a doubt. Hugely, hugely. So that's one thing I took from you, was like, you know, delay it as long, it's a late adolescence, as long as you possibly can.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm all about it. We see so many good results from that. In fact, I can't really tell you, and I may have a blind spot, Tom, and you have to tell me, but I don't see any negatives on waiting.
Yeah. The only negative is perception. It's parents being hounded by their kid, and it's like they finally just concede, all right, I can't take it anymore. Fine. And then, you know, and it's a big mistake.
Well, and I think sometimes it's even parent peers, parent to parent, they're the ones that have such a hard time. I think our kids sort of adapt. You know, I do feel like that a lot of parents are really worried, oh, if I take it away, if I don't give it to them, they're going to bug me for the next 5 years. You know, kids kind of give up at some point. I know you don't believe that out there if you've got a kid who's bugging you right now, but we present this to parents like your job is a coach. And Tom, I know you love coaching and you know a lot about sports and all that, but your job is like a coach. And that's why your job as the coach is to set the game plan, to set the rules. Your players don't do that. You do that. You're the coach. And also, this is the key that I bring in about that your team, your kids, they're supposed to trust you. You don't trust them. That's an adult character quality. That is not a thing that kids can do yet. So what we have found in our whole Screen Strong lifestyle that we talk about is that you really create this incredible bond with your kids. They do trust you. They don't hate you. They trust you. And your kids love you and they want you to step in and do the right thing and do the hard thing because they can't do the hard thing. And no kid has ever died because they didn't have a smartphone. It's just the fact. But there have been a lot of kids that have lost their life due to having a smartphone.
That's a fact. Unfortunately.
So it's just a matter of that delay. And in part two, we're going to pick up on part two next time when we bring you back. But part two of your book is on the technology effect on social, emotional, and family growth. And I love this part. And I love that you are so bold and you bring it up and talk about it. The whole chapter five is about video games. And then, you know, chapter six is all about that parenting that we're trying to figure out. And Tom, I think you would agree that really the best solutions to all of this are very simple. You know, I mean, you're in this business of helping families all the time. And if there's something that has 10 steps to it and it's really complicated, that's probably not the best way to go when it comes to parenting. I mean, you know, you have very simple things in here. You've got family time. You talk about the dinner time and the dinner table. I love that. Of course, everybody knows how I fight for that at our house. And, you know, we're all busy. So you have to really kind of make that a priority. Catching kids in the moment. Having screen-free vacations, what a concept. I mean, spring break is coming and going, and we've got all sorts of summer coming up here. We've got to talk about that. So we'll touch on that.
One thing I'll say too, Mel, I've been, you know, following your, obviously I follow everything that you do too. And your, you know, your Screen Strong Challenge.
Yeah.
7-day screens is fantastic. It's just a brilliant idea. So any people listening right now, you know, you may think, oh my God, I can't do this. What will happen is if you take this challenge for 7 days, you and your kids, you're going to find after that week, like, holy cow, like a jaw dropping, my God, this is life. Like, great.
Holy Who knew?
Yeah, I know. And you know, and you just don't realize, like, you know, human beings are creatures of habit. We just do the same thing over and over again. And all these devices and technologies designed, you know, to hook us in, hook, line, and sinker. And once we, you know, remove ourselves from all this stuff, you know, even just for 7 days, you know, it gives us a foundation now, you know, to kind of step back, a little R&R, rest and recovery, and say, and now to reanalyze, you know, our priorities and so forth. So right now, you know, there's all this stuff about big tech controlling our society because it is. And there's all this censorship, all this stuff. And people feel like, you know, people are complaining like that big tech has so much control over us. But guess what?
Right.
They don't have any control over us because we all have something called the delete button.
We have ultimate control.
Yeah. What is it? What is big tech heroin? No.
Yeah.
It's there's an addictive component to it. But we have, you know, with all this crazy social media stuff, you know what? We have they can delete people. We can delete them.
No, that's a really good point. Nobody says you have to do this. You know, we don't have a chip implanted in our brain quite yet. So nobody says you have to. You have complete, just like a coach, you're the coach of your team, of your family, and you get to decide how your season is going to go. And I mean, I love that analogy because it works really, really well. You have complete control over it. No, that's a really good point. That's a great point. Next time we're going to talk more about that. We're going to talk about the emotional development and how technology impacts learning in the digital classroom. I love that part. And then, of course, what parents can do. We'll wrap up. So I'm so excited that we don't have to say goodbye. We're going to say, see you next time. But Tom, can you just give our listeners, these parents out there that are really struggling, can you give them just a final word of encouragement before you go?
I heard this from a lecturer many years ago, and he said the following, and it always stood out to me. If your teenager doesn't hate you, you're doing something wrong. So
love it.
Your kid is going to give you some pushback. That's okay. That's part of being a parent. Nobody said it was easy, but it's our duty and you can do it.
Love it. I love that. That is such a great quote from like a great coach. You don't want your team to fall in love with you. You want to get their best potential and you want them to trust you and you want to win the championship. So I love that quote so much. Thank you so much. That's, and you know, in 2 weeks or so, we're going to have you back and we're going to finish this discussion. If anybody out there has any more questions for Tom, email us and we will get them to answer the questions. So Tom, thank you so much. I know you got to run. You've got patients coming in. We appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Great, great catching up, Mel.
Well, good. Well, I hope all of you enjoyed listening today. Remember to subscribe, rate, and share this podcast with your friends and head over to our website to donate and to learn more about our Screen Strong Challenge that Tom was just talking about. Also, make sure to join our Screen Strong Families Facebook group where you are going to find wonderful support from other parents just like you that are struggling. Remember, we've got your back and we are here to help you. So until next time, stand up for your kids, stand out from the crowd, and stay strong.